This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
This word equanimity is it's a strange word. When I first started meditating, I couldn't even spell it. I kept trying to look it up on the internet because Noah kept saying equanimity. And for those of you who are vowel challenged like I am, it's EQUANIMITY, equanimity. It's that A, man, messed me up for a long time. And I'd never really heard this word. I got a sort of sense that there was an idea of like some balance in there, you know, but I struggled with this word. So whenever I find a new word, of course, I try to find some definitions. One definition I really liked for the Buddhist sense of equanimity is the balance between the deep desire to help and a wise acknowledgement of our limitations. So there's this, you know, sort of heart sense balanced with this wisdom in equanimity. Another one similar is a perfect, unshakable balance of mind rooted in insight. There's actually two different Pali words that mean or translate as equanimity. You know, whenever we're dealing with Buddhism, we're dealing with the fact that we're like, we got a language that's dead that was translated in another language that's now translated in our language, and anybody who speaks more than one language knows that something gets lost there. So I try to hit it with a lot of different definitions, and there's upekkha, which I think we're all very familiar with, those of us who have kind of been around the scene and, you know, like to read the Buddha books, right? And this idea of equanimity is to look over, right? This understanding aspect of equanimity, right? To not be so blown around by things. There's also this other word that means equanimity that I like to try to pronounce because it sounds kind of funny, and that's Tatra Maja Ha Ta Ta Ha, something like that. It's totally wrong, by the way, for those of you listening at home. And this other word, which I cannot pronounce, but it's fun to say, is it means to stand in the middle of all of this, to stand in the middle of all things. So we've got this sort of seeing with understanding, right? And then this balance, this sort of inner strength aspect of equanimity. And I think you need the two. For those of you who don't do so good with that and need a visual, this is the visual that I really like. I lived on a boat when I was a kid. And when you go out to sea, you get your sea legs, right? And no matter what the ocean throws at you, and it always throws something that's completely unexpected, right? You've got to keep, you know, standing up. Otherwise, you're going to fall overboard, you know? And then it pitches and it rolls and goes up and down. And all of a sudden, you know, something happens and somebody tells you to duck. And it's just, you know, all sorts of sort of controlled chaos going on. And I like to think of equanimity as that for my life. You know, it's this mindful sort of preparedness based in loving kindness where I sort of allows me to sort of, you know, ride the ship of life. So that's what, for those of you in a more visual painting of it. you know, but we really need, I really need this equanimity because I'm knocked off balance. Equanimity is one of the things that we develop in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. It's one of these so-called seven factors of enlightenment, right? The enlightened person just sort of naturally has this. And the Buddha has this sort of very obscure instruction for, well, you know, notice if these things arise and then try to develop them. And then that's all he really says. And I was like, well, what does that mean? Because here I am, I'm getting tossed around all the time. You know, the things that toss us around from the Buddhist perspective are known as the eight worldly winds. For those of you keeping track of the lists at home, you hear them all the time. I just like the names of the lists. I like to find the names of the lists. And we've got, these are your praise and blame, the loss and gain, the pleasure and pain, the fame and disrepute, right? And one half of those things we really like, you know, when they go away, that throws us off balance. And then the other half of the things, when they show up, that throws us off balance, you know. And that these that equanimity is what gives us the protection from this. Because the world is going to do these things to us. These eight worldly winds are going to happen to all of us. We're all going to experience some of these things some of the time. It's inevitable. So this equanimity is our protection against that. It's what allows us to stand in the middle of all of this. One of the teachers who comes here, Ken McLeod, said once, and I really liked this instruction, and I try to remember this when I'm teaching. He said, so many meditation teachers focus on the results and not on the methods. Right? It was so easy for us to get in sort of the philosophical discussion. And when Jordan and I were putting this talk together, he's like, well, make sure you talk about, you know, how does one develop equanimity? Because it's great to understand equanimity and know the definition, you know, intellectually get it, but that doesn't make it come to pass. Just because I know something doesn't mean that I am that. If I could do that, I wouldn't really need meditation. If I could just sort of figure things out and then just make it happen, you know, life would be a lot easier. But that's not the way it is. At least that's not my experience. So he actually, there's actually suggestions on how to develop the ground that allows equanimity to arise. Equanimity is one of those things, in my experience, that we just plant the ground for it. It flowers on its own. We don't make the flower of equanimity. It arises when we tend to the field. When we tend to certain things, it will come naturally. And these are the seven mental qualities that support the development of equanimity, for those of you paying attention at home. The first one is the idea of developing some virtue or some integrity. If we can walk into a room and we know we're blameless, we know we're upright, that we're following certain moral precepts, then that gives us a certain sense of equanimity. And throughout the Buddhist practice, there's always this discussion of needing to be, you know, the blameless, right? That you take right action. Also, our equanimity needs to be rooted in, I don't like to use the word faith, but deep conviction, a deep understanding. For example, when I'm in traffic and I really want to get angry at this person in front of me, maybe I want to get out of my car, maybe I want to roll down my window, I have to know that anger only breeds more anger and never more peace. And I have to have that deep conviction if I'm not going to be thrown off by my anger, especially here in Los Angeles when it's not the holidays. A well-developed mind is important, that we have to be rooted in mindfulness, that we have to be aware of these things as they arise, which of course is, you know, what we're developing in our meditation practice. So just meditating, practicing mindfulness develops our equanimity. My favorite on this list is well-being. In other words, taking care of ourselves. You know, knowing when you need to take a time out from the world and take a bath with some Epsom salts, maybe a little lavender, you know, go get a massage. Like, take care of ourselves, you know, work out, all of those things. We have to, you know, care for ourselves, especially if we're going to care for others. Having an understanding, a deep understanding of wisdom, that especially of karma, this understanding that other people are responsible for their own karma, and that although I can help them and although I can offer this, ultimately, just like I'm responsible for my actions, they are responsible for theirs. Again, we don't want to have to carry around the karma of the whole world. Insight, very important for developing equanimity, specifically the insights around the areas of impermanence. If we know these eight worldly winds are blowing us around, if we can also have some sense that it's just impermanent. You know, like Noah always tells this story about this Chinese farmer and all these things happen to him, and no matter what happens to him, he just says, you know, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. This knowledge that, like, it's going to come and it's going to go. And then the last one, which Jordan's actually going to talk about a little bit more, is freedom. Letting go of some of our reactive tendencies. Knowing that we don't have to hold on to everything that comes along. You know, it's like knowing that when someone gives us some praise, somebody's going to come along for the exact same behavior and criticize us for the exact same thing that we did. You know, and just not being quite so reactive. The last thing I want to say about equanimity and its development, Sharon Salzberg, I listened to one of her talks on equanimity that's on the web for in preparation for this talk, and she really talks about equanimity needing to be spacious. I really like this term, spacious. The more that I sit, the more that I feel that this is really important to develop spaciousness. And there's actually a really cool Buddha quote about this sort of spaciousness. She says in her talk that we need to develop a mind so filled with love that it resembles space which cannot be ruined, marred, or painted. Develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space. So if compassion is the trembling of the quivering heart in response to suffering, then equanimity is the spacious stillness that can accept things as they are.
Well put. As I was preparing my part of the Dharma talk, I was driving here after I had typed up my notes, and I was filled with so much doubt on my way here, and my mind was saying, this is such a far out concept. I feel like I just touch the tip of it. How the hell am I supposed to really impart this amazing and radical idea of equanimity to whoever I'm talking to? And so, with that said, as you're listening to what I have to say, and you're reflecting on what Joseph has said, and you're thinking of the meditation that we experienced, I ask of you, please think of it as with the understanding that this is theoretical knowledge, and the way to truly experience equanimity is to go home and feel it for yourself. The only way for this to be any sort of transformative teaching in our lives is for us to have a real direct experience of what it is like to be equanimous. And so as I say whatever I'm going to say, please be aware of whatever feelings come up in response to what you hear, whatever thoughts you have in response to what you hear. I was really excited to, in my researching and studying of equanimity, of upekkha as I've always known it, I came across the Tatramata Mandada word. And I really love that word. The idea to stand in the middle of all of this. It reminds me of a Leonard Cohen quote. Forgive me if I get this wrong, but it was something to the effect of, learn to be like a buoy or you'll be seasick all day. You know, and that idea that the buoy is always sort of upright, even in the waves and in the storm. And that's sort of how I'm viewing equanimity these days. There's a wonderful teacher against the stream. Her name is Mary. And I've noticed that Mary loves to talk about the moments of freedom. That the Buddha's third noble truth, that suffering can be ended, the cessation of suffering, sometimes can seem like a real lofty, unattainable goal. And I love hearing Mary talk about these moments of freedom throughout the day. And this idea of equanimity, to me, is my direct connection to those glimpses, those moments of contentment, of it's okay. One of the definitions of equanimity that I picked up on is the power to see without being caught by what we're seeing. Let me start that over. The power to see without being caught by what we see. And for me, that sort of gives equanimity a little bit more emotion. It stops it from being this sort of cold idea of being placid or unaffected. Because that is absolutely not what we're going for when talking about equanimity. So the idea of it not just being when we're equanimous, when we have equanimity, we're not simply talking about being even keeled or passive or unaffected. Shinzen Young, a Dharma teacher, he defines equanimity as the radical permission to feel. And I love that idea of the radical permission to feel and not being thrown to either side of the spectrum of clinging and grasping and pushing away an aversion. To really allow ourselves to feel and be centered. Joseph mentioned a lot of lists. And equanimity is one of the ideas or states of mind that appears on a bunch of lists. It appears on the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections, the 7 factors of enlightenment, and the 4 Brahma Viharas, divine abodes. And it's interesting to me where equanimity Equanimity. I like equanimity. It sounds good to me. Well, whatever it is, it appears at the end of the list, which is really interesting to me. And it gives me that the notion that equanimity encompasses the things that came before it. I'd like to speak a little bit on equanimity and the four Brahma Viharas. So we have in Pali, the language the Buddhists spoke, we have metta for loving kindness, we have karuna for compassion, we have mudita for sympathetic joy, and we have upekkha for equanimity. And as Joseph was speaking on equanimity as being that backbone, that stabilizing force, for me it's been very important to understand it as the connective force as well. And that with equanimity, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy are not isolated virtues. It's very easy for me to feel love and to allow that love to be very clingy. And my compassion, my want to help, my want for others to be happy, I can get very clingy to that as well. And my sympathetic joy, my joy in others' happiness, I can... equanimity allows me to not sort of rest on my laurels. So if someone gets a new car, I can have joy for them. But equanimity allows me to say, be happy for them, but know that they got a new car. And that this is not going to relieve them of the real sort of suffering that goes on in life. Right? It gives love, patience, and balance. And it gives compassion, courage, and fearlessness. When we're looking at all the suffering in the world, it's so easy to just say, fuck it. It's too much suffering. A Dharma teacher named Dipama says that calls equanimity dynamic stillness. I like that. Dynamic stillness. And in Dipama's writing, he says, dynamic stillness is the crowning stage of Buddhist training, where consciousness becomes a symphony of loving kindness playing in a silent ocean of equanimity. It's where consciousness becomes a symphony of loving kindness playing in an ocean of equanimity. So equanimity sort of sets the stage for all the sort of wonders to manifest. At Against the Stream, we always are talking about mindfulness and being aware. And it's been my experience that my mindfulness has produced more mindfulness. And that when I become aware of something, I then am more inclined to be aware of that in the future. Just the same as when we draw our attention to the breath, and we get distracted and we draw our attention back to the breath, it strengthens our ability to focus and be mindful of the breath. I think that the same idea, that same concept, needs to be utilized in the realm and the idea of equanimity. And that the more we can acknowledge when we have moments of equanimity, when we can be aware that we are being equanimous, it sets the stage for us to be just even more equanimous in the next moment and in the following. I was walking down the street the other day with my brother's friend, and he said, I was kind of in a good mood, and he says, "Jordan, are you always happy?" I thought to myself, "No, but come to think of it, I'm happy a lot of the time now." And as he recognized that idea, you know, recognized my happiness, as he acknowledged it, I sort of felt kind of inspired, and I was able to say to myself, "Yeah, I am." You know, and it sort of gave me that little push to strive for it a little bit more. And it's been my experience that when I recognize the moments in which I have equanimity, I then get to feel inspired by my own practice. And then I become the sort of fuel that perpetuates my ongoing path, if that makes sense. Equanimity is the fuel to my spiritual practice. We're running out of time, so I'm going to leave you with a quote. Actually, before the quote, there's a story in the suttas, and this, I believe it was in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is one of the books of the suttas. It is about this really wealthy merchant. And he was really known for his generosity and his compassion. And he had this cousin who was a degenerate gambler, and he squandered all his money away. And this merchant, out of the kindness of his heart, out of wanting to be generous and compassionate, he gave his cousin a bunch of money. But the cousin took that money and he squandered it away and he gambled it away. And eventually, bookies came after him because he squandered all his money away, and they killed him. And the guy was all distraught and he was so in so much pain about it. And he went up to the Buddha and he said, "Buddha, I gave my cousin all this money and I did what I can do. But he, you know, he threw it all away and now he's dead. I should have done more for him. I should have given him more money. I should have protected him." And the Buddha said, "You have done all you could. Now is the time for equanimity." You know, to bring it full circle, equanimity is the stabilizing sort of force to keep our emotions, whatever they may be, in check. And to understand that we are not going to save anybody. It reminds me the Buddha's last teaching to everybody reminds me of the idea of equanimity. And he says, be diligent in your practice, be a light unto yourself. Work out your own salvation with diligence. And even the Buddha recognized he's not going to save anybody. He can be an open book. He can present you with the information and the tools, but he cannot do it for you. And he was very much at peace with that understanding. And so Ajahn Chah says this. He says, the heart of the path is so simple. No need for long explanations. Give up clinging and just rest with things as they are. This is all I do in my own practice. And yeah, I really love that idea of give up clinging, rest in what is, and that's all you got to do. And it sort of really simplifies. Now we're done here. I say that, and I picked this quote, and I understand that there's potential to oversimplify this, but I do that to hopefully counterbalance at least my mode of operation, which is to overthink and over-intellectualize and to make things more complicated than they are. And so I leave you with equanimity is feeling truly centered, and that there's so much freedom attainable in this very moment with feeling centered. And give yourself credit when you feel centered, and acknowledge that, oh, this is equanimity, because that will create more. And then it will create more and more and more, and then we're done. So, that's what I have.
Dope.
Nice. Welcome.
Yeah. You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.